Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the J.P. Morgan Aviation, Transportation, and Industrials Conference. We're back. I'm Seth Seifman, the Aerospace Defense Equity Research Analyst here, and we are honored to have Ken Possenriede from Lockheed Martin, the new CFO, here to join us, and he's gonna talk with us, and I think we're just gonna have a discussion and answer some questions. Greg Gardner is here as well, from Investor Relations. Maybe just to kick it off in a very general way, Ken, if you talk a little bit about, you know, you're new to the position, a little bit about your background and your goals as the CFO, and kind of what you see as the main challenges and opportunities facing the company.
You bet, Seth. Thanks for having me. Hey, just a quick housekeeping matter. So what you have in front of you is our forward-looking statement. So statements made today that are not historical facts will be considered forward-looking statements and are made pursuant to our safe harbor provisions as part of the federal securities law. What I'd ask everyone to do is take a look at our recently filed 10-K, and you will see a list of all risks that may materially impact our future results if they came to fruition. So housekeeping's over, and give a little background on me. So I've been with Lockheed Martin for 30-plus years. Started out as a heritage IBMer, got bought twice, ended up at Lockheed Martin. I historically, Seth, have worked in an operation probably 28 of those years and did a stint in Treasury for 5 years. I've worked in aeronautics. I've worked in rotary mission systems, missiles and fire control, space, and other parts of the business. So I've got a good operational background. Did you ask priorities for this year?
Yeah, maybe some of your key goals as CFO and some of the main opportunities and challenges for the company.
Sure. So I think priorities this year, you know, it's a fewfold. One is, you know, make sure the company's performing on the portfolio that we have. So if you look at some of our, what I'll call more mature products, make sure F-35 and our tactical weapons, strike fighter programs are performing flawlessly. We have a lot of development programs. Make sure that they're performing, and let's get them out of development and into production. You know, some of the opportunities we have, you know, we'll talk about this today. We are proud of the portfolio that we have. We think we have a very strong portfolio. Sure, we'll talk about budgets today, federal budgets. You know, generally speaking, based on the portfolio we have, generally speaking, we feel good about the direction the budgets are going. They're trending upward, and we think the products we have, the services that we perform are supported by the services and Congress. And we also think, you know, back on the performance aspect, we do think there are some opportunities, say, on F-35 and our missile system programs, that there's some opportunities there for us. You know, challenges, I think, you know, like a lot of companies, there are pieces of our business that are growing, so we are out hiring, and one of the difficult things in the aerospace and defense market is some of these folks need security clearances, so we're focused on that to get these folks in the door, get them cleared so they can go work on our mission work. I mentioned earlier about the development programs. We do have some development programs out there that, you know, could be a challenge. We won two classified programs, one in ADP, which is our Skunk Works for aeronautics, and another one in missiles and fire control. We also have some development programs at Sikorsky. It's the combat search and rescue helicopter, our SH-53K, and presidential helicopter. We've got F-16. We thought it was dead, the production piece of it. It's alive and well, and it's starting up now in our Greenville, South Carolina operation. And we've got some exciting starts in RMS with the Canadian Surface Combatant program and a new program, the Homeland Radar defense program out of Hawaii. So, you know, we've got processes in place that we think will manage these challenges, but like all companies, we have them.
Sure. I guess, you know, it wouldn't be a Lockheed Martin discussion if we didn't start it off maybe talking about the F-35. And, you know, this is obviously a key issue for investors. And maybe I'll share with you a little bit the way I think about the next couple of years, and you could tell me maybe what's right and what's wrong about that. You know, in terms of the top line, you know, this is percentage of completion accounting. So, you know, it's not so much about the deliveries, it's about the work that you're doing. And so by next year, you'll probably be doing work on 160 aircraft, which we've thought of as kind of full rate production on a cost-to-cost basis. And based on the, you know, objective of the Defense Department to get prices down, unit prices down, there's some downward pricing pressure. There's some mix changes as well. So, you know, that suggests that as we get into the early 2020s, maybe there's a plateau, maybe even some pressure on the production part. You know, on the other hand, there are thoughts about raising the rate higher than 160. And there's also, you know, a pretty substantial sustainment piece that's growing briskly. So when you roll all that together, how do you think about the growth profile for the F-35 program going into the early 2020s?
Yeah, you're more right than not. So, you know, if you look at F-35, you know, so this year we're going to deliver 131 aircraft. So that's basically the lion's share of our LRIP 11. So which means we're now starting to do long lead work on LRIP 12 and LRIP 13. Next year, we'll deliver about 145 aircraft, and then we'll get that up to, in around 2023, about 160. Peak with the final assembly and checkout operations in Italy and Japan, plus our Fort Worth operation, think of that as roughly about 180 aircraft. You know, give or take. We'll see that continue out into the future, you know, out to the middle of the next decade, maybe a little bit longer. And as you said, I think the thing we're focused on now is, can we continue to become more efficient, look at our span time, reduce our spans to grow that capacity? And then, frankly, does it make sense? You know, we'll do the trade-offs. Should we expand capacity in Fort Worth? You know, we're not there yet, but, you know, we certainly would do the business case if that made sense. Development program, we're basically out of the SDD, or we are out of SDD. We're now doing operational tests and evaluation to get to what's called Milestone C, so we then can get into full lot production. That's going well. You talked about sustainment. So we are standing up bases, we are buying the appropriate spares, and we are doing the appropriate repairs that need to be done. We're driving down cost. We're ensuring that availability is where we need it to be, or where the customer needs it to be. And we'll start modernizing the previous lot aircraft to get to the right technology. You will see sustainment grow, continue to grow. It'll probably be for the next couple years out into the middle of the decade, our fastest growing piece of F-35. Back on the production, we feel good about the negotiations that we are getting with our Joint Program Office customer from a cost standpoint and from a profitability standpoint. So we do think there is some margin potential increases on production in the out years.
Okay. So, I mean, it sounds like then when you roll all of that together, between moving, you know, maybe moving north of 160 and growing the sustainment piece, you know, you expect the total F-35 revenue contribution to continue growing?
It will continue to grow, probably not as fast as you've seen in the last couple of years, though.
Right.
But we should still see growth.
Okay. And then within that sustainment piece, you know, you mentioned it's growing quickly, and, you know, some of that is because the fleet is growing, and some of that is because we're still relatively early in deploying the fleet. When you think strategically about Lockheed's role in that and what you want it to be over time, you know, how do you see that evolving? Over what period of time do you see that evolving? What does it make the most sense for Lockheed to do to sustain this aircraft long term, and what would be best put to other players, whether it's your suppliers or the government or others?
Yeah, so we're having that conversation now internally and with our customer set. So, you know, the pieces I described basically is, you know, all of sustainment for F-35. There is likely pieces of this that will go back to the government, no different than on other platforms that came before the F-35 program. I think the pieces that you will continue to see to grow is the modernization piece, which I would think, you know, based on past history and based on our skill set, the value we add would be the modernization piece. There may be pieces of the repair of the aircraft that will go elsewhere, but it's likely there's parts of the repair piece that will continue staying with Lockheed Martin. You know, our assumption today is just from a scale standpoint, it would make sense for us to continue buying spares. So we would continue to do that, and then over time, the standing up of the bases are going to diminish over time. So that probably will not be as material to sustainment as it is today. So we still think there's value in Lockheed Martin doing a sizable amount of the F-35 work with us and our partners.
Yeah, and when you think about what that might be, you know, out in the out years, once the fleet is more fully stood up, would that still be potentially, you know, 25% of F-35 sales?
I think that's a good number, or potentially could be north of 25%.
Okay. Great. And then, you mentioned profitability on the program, and I think, you guys have talked about bringing that up this year a little bit north of 10% and getting close, you know, around the margin for the aeronautics business as a whole. How much opportunity should we think about beyond that level?
Right. So what we provided with guidance is taking up profit on F-35 by about 50 basis points. That's a little bit below the aeronautics margins. You know, looking out into the future, as I described earlier, we feel good about the negotiations we concluded on LRIP 11 in terms of the cost target. And we had an interesting twist on that program. Not only did we negotiate a fixed fee, we worked with the customer to come up with a performance incentive fee to incentivize us to reduce span time on final assembly. And if we're successful there and hit our cost, you could see some superior margins there. I think we're going to, in the future, try to come up with the same type of schematics on the block buy and the multi-year. So there is opportunity for us to grow our margins at an F-35 and, frankly, be above the aeronautics margins.
Excellent. And outside of the F-35, but still within the aeronautics business, you mentioned reviving the F-16 in South Carolina. Can you talk about the production outlook there? What does the backlog look like? What do you think is a sustainable production rate for that program over what period of time?
Sure. So, if we were here 2 years ago, we would have been talking about delivering the last Iraqi two aircraft, eight of them that year, and we basically thought the line was finished, and we did had a nice deal come to us with Bahrain, FMS contract. We're in the throes of negotiating Slovakia, so Bahrain is 16 aircraft, Slovakia is 14 aircraft, and I'm sure you saw in the press that the Bulgarians are interested in buying their aircraft as well, so we'll work that. That would be additional eight aircraft. There are other countries out there that are interested, Indonesia, Morocco, Taiwan is interested. We'll see how far that goes. And then, obviously, the big one is India. And, you know, we'll be working that for quite some time now. But, think of once we get up and going, the first aircraft delivery for Bahrain will be the end of 2021. And then I think in the foreseeable future, you'll see us deliver about eight aircraft a year. We basically have capacity to do about 24 aircraft there, so I think we're in good shape for a while.
Okay. Excellent. And then another legacy platform is the C-130J, where things have been pretty steady for quite a while, around 24 aircraft per year. How do we think about the sustainability of that rate and what demand is looking out to the out years?
So right now, what we're working on is what's called multi-year two, and we'll deliver 28 aircraft this year. We had a good order book year last year for C-130. We got a tranche of congressional ads, and plus we got an order for 6 German aircraft. We're now working with the customer on multi-year three, and once that's concluded, plus a few more international orders and a few other additional add-ons, we see a path to do low to mid 20s deliveries for the next couple years, which is a nice surprise. We didn't see that a couple years ago.
Okay. Maybe moving on to the missiles and fire control business, which is the fastest growing segment at the company right now. Can you talk about the level of visibility you have on growth there and maybe the sources of growth? We know, you know, some of it comes from the fact that the operational tempo has been high in recent years and there's a certain amount of demand for consumables that drives. And even when the operational tempo slows down, there's replenishment of stocks. But there's also a lot of advanced activity on new programs going on there. So maybe if you could, you know, break down the contributors and talk a little bit about how much growth you see going out into the 2020s.
Sure. So we see a lot of demand for our missile defense work. You probably saw earlier this week we got a roughly $950 million order from the Saudi Arabia customer for THAAD for the long lead and obsolescence piece. We're in the throes of negotiating with MDA to get the remaining piece of that. So we're optimistic that will happen hopefully in the not too distant future. Our capital spend this year will be higher than it has been from a historical standpoint. A lot of that is going towards expanding our capacity on our munitions business, our strike weapons, tactical weapons business. We're in the throes of expanding our Hellfire production line from 7,000 units a year up to 11,000. Our Patriot, our PAC-3 capacity today is 250. We're taking that up to 500. And those respective customers have been in lockstep with us on that investment, you know, based on their demand. So we're bullish in the long term for that to have continued growth, along with our defense business. The other twist is we've been successful in hypersonics, and a lot of that is out of the missiles and fire control organization. We won a program called Arrow, which is a air-launched rapid response weapon, and that's complementary to our tactical boost glide program that we won with aeronautics teams with missiles and fire control. They also won a program called Hacksaw, which is a hypersonic conventional strike weapon. And if you add all these programs up with the space hypersonics program we won, we've got a backlog of $2.5 billion on hypersonics that we'll perform on for the next couple years. And then, you know, frankly, we'll see where that goes from a production standpoint. But our, as you said, it's the fastest growing portfolio with the highest margin portfolio business, and it will continue to be that way in the future.
Right, and that $2.5 billion hypersonics backlog you mentioned, that we think about that as kind of a for various development efforts, and then maybe 3-4 years out, we'll see kind of what develops in terms of production in hypersonics. Is that kind of a approximate time frame to think about how that market's going to evolve?
I think that's right. So, you know, some of those programs I mentioned, first launch, one of the programs, Hacksaw, will be out in 2020. A couple of the other ones will be the year after that, and one will be out into the 2023 time period. So, yeah, I think you'll see these development programs go on for the next 3-4 years, and then I think we've got to work with the customer based on their needs and the sense of urgency that's out there for hypersonics, where that goes from a production standpoint.
And you know, you mentioned the additional capital that you guys are putting to work in missiles and fire control this year, and it's striking. I mean, even last year, it kind of stepped up fairly significantly. How do you think about the return on capital there, and you know, elsewhere in the business, in terms of the time frame over which you know you look to see those returns and the level?
Sure. So the example we used in missiles and fire control, which is a large chunk of the increase in capital demand this year, it is an easy business case because, again, you look at our customer has given us their forecast. They're in full support of us growing that capacity. So high margin business, it makes sense. And most of this is for buildings, which we're going to depreciate over quite a few years, but even so, it is accretive to what we're doing. So it may absolutely make sense for us to make these capital investments.
Yep. That makes sense. And then when you think about more from a return on sales perspective, you know, the margin level, missiles and fire control are around the mid 14 range now, and I think you know that reflects a lot of some of the new work that you guys have won, which is important to drive future growth. Does the pace of that new work mean that there's additional pressure on that margin going forward? Can it stay where it is, or you know, do we start to see it migrate higher?
I think it's sustainable where it is. There are some you know, puts and takes where some of the margins will be accretive, but you'll have some development programs that will be dilutive to margins. So I think you'll see, you know, a steady state return with the fastest growing business.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, looking at the rotary and mission systems business, you know, the guidance there this year is for fairly modest growth on the top line, pretty modest profit growth. And maybe you could lay out what some of the headwinds are there this year, because the business was extremely strong last year. And, you know, we know there's a little bit of pressure on Black Hawk, but Sikorsky also has some new development programs. And, in the legacy Lockheed Martin mission systems business, in a growing budget environment, there's obviously a lot of programs there that might benefit. So, you know, how do we think about that walk from 2018 to 2019?
Yeah. So, you know, top line, if you look at Sikorsky, yeah, you're right. We have, if you look at the Black Hawk, the Lot 9 program relative to the previous lot, it's less units, so there is headwinds there. Also, the Romeo program is winding down, so there's some headwinds there. Think of that as being offset by some of the training and simulation work that's done out of our Orlando operation. We'll counter that. And if you look at some of the other puts and takes throughout the rest of the Heritage portfolio, that's why you see at the top line year over year, it's flattish. We did have some nice margin expansion last year. A lot of that was due to Sikorsky. This year, as I mentioned earlier, we want to see some of those development programs, the CH-53, the presidential helicopter, the search and rescue, the combat search and rescue helicopter, start pushing those out of development, get them into production, and hope there's some good bottom line margin expansion there.
Right. And I think you'd worked on the Sikorsky acquisition to some degree.
Yep.
Yeah,
I did.
And so when you look at where you guys are on that journey now, how do you feel about where that stands?
So if you look at the synergy assumptions, the costs that we tried to take out from a redundancy standpoint, integrating them into the portfolio, we're very happy, very pleased with where they are today. It pretty much is in line with what we assumed a couple years ago. Where we have seen it not be as successful is frankly at the top line and operationally bottom line. Some of these development programs have they've been in development longer than we anticipated, so we're still pleased with the acquisition. It's just some of these programs are going to move into production later than we assume, but we still think we made the right choice. We think we're the better owner.
Excellent. Okay, and maybe moving to the space business, space is a key focus area for the Defense Department, starting to think more seriously about protecting space assets from attack. You know, the space, you guys have talked about being kind of a flattish business over the next several years. Can you talk about the, you know, what's causing that to be the case in, you know, what seems like a kind of, you know, fertile environment for space?
Right. So, you know, there's been a lot of buzz about a space agency. You know, right now we haven't seen anything change from a program or record standpoint. And space probably does have the longest gestation of, you know, cradle to grave from a performance standpoint to before the satellites go out the door. You know, a lot of strong advocacy from the customer set, you know, with our SBIRS program. We just got the OPIR follow-on work for SBIRS, which is it's an overhead persistent infrared, which will be the next generation of SBIRS work. GPS-3, strong contingency. Orion, strong contingency. We're just not seeing any growth there. And, you know, maybe in the future, if the space agency concept comes into fruition, we will we'll see some of that. I did mention we did get a rather large hypersonic deal for space. So, you know, we'll see where that goes as well.
Excellent. Last year in the fall, you know, we saw some news about an effort that the Defense Department was making to, you know, change the way it makes progress payments to contractors. That was subsequently pulled back, and I think most people seem to think for good reason. But, you know, the department's still out meeting, I believe, you know, meeting with companies about this. There's a GAO report that I think will probably come out soon on the topic. Do you see this issue going away? Do you see it sticking around? And to the extent that it sticks around, is there, you know, is there a win-win outcome for both contractors and the government?
You're right. So we're dealing with a new face. So there's an interim director of contracts and pricing that we're dealing with now. And what you said is correct. We've had some industry conversations with them AIA-wise, but also Lockheed Martin. And I know other of our competitors, colleagues, have gone in to see the team as well. And, you know, what we're trying to advocate is we're all for on-time deliveries. We're all for performing. Let's find a way that is win-win to exactly as you described, that incentivizes us to deliver product, quality product on time. I think we're going to be talking about this for a while. But we're hopeful we'll be able to get to a happy medium that's fair for the government and fair for the industry.
Okay, excellent. You know, in valuing defense stocks, there's a number of ways that investors look at that. You know, and cash flow is obviously an important part of that. And so, in terms of forecasting cash flow, you know, working capital is an important component of that. And so is there a shorthand way you would say to think about the working capital trends at the company in a period where the top line's growing like it is now, either in terms of, you know, in terms of days or percent of sales or, you know, things to be aware of over the next 2 to 3 years?
Yes. So if you look at our portfolio, the fastest growing pieces are missile defense and tactical weapons business, and our F-35 part of the aeronautics portfolio. We are growing working capital, and I would expect to see working capital continue to grow probably out to the 2021 time period, 2022 time period. And I think it goes back to the earlier conversation we had about F-35 deliveries. Once you start seeing though they'll continue to grow, they'll grow at a slower pace, you'll start seeing where that's sitting is unbilled accounts receivable or inventory. You'll start seeing us convert that to cash quicker than frankly earnings in that time period, and you'll start to see working capital start to reduce at that time.
Right, and in the meantime, the growth there might So, you know, the working capital, we'd expect it to grow somewhat because the top line is growing, but, you know, might grow even in excess of that in the interim?
It'll grow in parallel as the earnings grow, but there'll be that gap between earnings and working capital up until we get to about the 2022 time period.
So pension is another topic that I'm sure you're going to spend a great deal of time talking about with investors.
Perhaps
that's already started today. There's always something new to learn about pension. But obviously one of the main drivers of your required pension contributions is market returns. And so, not so much because the date matters, but just to illustrate how this stuff can shift around, you know, how would things have been different if the year had ended on January 31st instead of December 31st relative to the types of contributions you talked about making for 2020 and 2021?
We would obviously be in better shape, but right. It's a long game. You know, what we're assuming is a long-term rate of return of 7%. Unfortunately, we did -5% last year. Right. But if you go back a year prior to that, I think it was 13%. So, we're going to assume 7% long-term. Discount rate of 4.25%. We're off to a great start this year, but we got a long way to go.
Right, and the the outstanding CAS prepayment balance that you guys highlight in the 10-K, I think it's about $8.5 billion now.
Right.
How do we think about the period at which is there a period at which CAS and contributions are more or less harmonized? Is that still the goal here, and if so, when roughly should we think about that happening?
Yeah, so we will not make a pension contribution this year. We will make round numbers a $500 million pension contribution next year, but think of the CAS recovery all the way out till 2026 will be higher than any pension contributions we have to make. And you'll see that, get close to harmonized around the 2026 time period. It'll be very close.
Okay, so still several years.
We'll be talking about it for a while.
Okay, very, very good. And we saw the company take some actions in the fourth quarter to offload some of its pension obligations. Is that foreshadowing anything else we might see in the future?
Yeah, so we did roughly $2.6 billion, affected 41,000 retirees, done in two tranches. The thing we wanted to be very careful about, wanted to ensure we over-communicated, not just with the street, but certainly with the retirees. It appears, as we sit here today, little concern by our retiree base. We have, round numbers of $40 billion worth of liabilities. So, we're going to take this one step at a time. The one of the deals we did was an option. We still have to explore probably next year what we do with that, if we're going to monetize that and, put sunset that that plan next year. And, we'll look over time and see if it makes sense to chip away and do other pieces of it. It obviously, because of its size, can't be done in one fell swoop. So we'll still be talking about this for a while. The question is, are there incremental pieces that we could continue to move to an insurance company who's obviously better at this than we are?
Okay, great. And then, when we just to round out the pension point, how do you think about what sustainable or normalized cash flow is for Lockheed, given, right now we have an outsized contribution from CAS recoveries this year, but that'll start to come down in 2020 and 2021. You guys have talked about generating at least $7 billion of operating cash in each of 2020 and 2021. but you've got top line growth, and we've got pension and working capital mm-hmm. dynamics. How do you think about where the opportunity is to do better than $7 billion, and then also that question of what you think about is the sustainable kind of normalized cash flow for the company?
Sure. So yeah, you're right. We've provided guidance of $7 billion in 2020 and $7 billion in 2021. We actually see our CAS recoveries staying pretty consistent out to probably 2023, and then they'll start coming down. And I think, you know, the earlier conversation we had with F-35, once you start getting out into that time period, what we see is our back on the unbilled AR, it'll start to come down and start hopefully offsetting that reduction in CAS recoveries. I mean, the other things we'll look at, it goes back, to the focus items. Look at margin expansion out in that time period, which would, obviously generate cash. Are there other things from a bid and proposal standpoint that we can do that can help shape accelerating some cash flow, international customers getting advances, and other working capital initiatives that we can do to help offset that reduction that will start, beyond 2023.
Right. Okay. I guess big event next week. We'll get the budget release. First step in what will probably be a very long and, if the recent past is any indication, a painful process. But I guess what are you looking for next week, and what do you think might be some of the big, or if any, surprises we might see in the 20 budget request?
Yeah, assuming it comes next week, and you're spot on, I think we'll be talking about this for quite some time. I think the interesting piece will be is let's see what the investment counts say. We're like anybody else. We're going to be very focused on where that is and try to work from an advocacy standpoint with the right folks to make sure the programs we believe in that should be fully funded or funded appropriately, we'll make sure we work that. But, again, if you go around the horn and we have $130 billion of backlog, unless there's a major crisis, which we're hoping does not happen, we feel pretty good about our portfolio, where we are and where it's going. If this thing runs its normal course, which will be chaos, unfortunately, we feel pretty good about where things are going to land.
Excellent. Well, we've got about 2 minutes left, so I definitely want to open it up and see if there are any questions from the room.
Hey, thanks very much. So I just wanted to ask about cash flow and capital allocation for 2018. And I guess, correct me where I'm wrong here, I think you're guiding to greater than $7.4 billion in cash flow from operations and $1.5 billion of CapEx. So it gives you, call it $5.9 billion in free cash. And you've got $2.5 billion in dividend and another $1 billion in repos. It leaves you, call it, $2.5 billion in unallocated free cash flow. How should we think about how you're going to use that money?
So right now, we're planning. We have a bond that matures in the fourth quarter of this year. We're planning on retiring that. We've got some time yet to determine whether we're going to do that or refi it. But right now, the assumption is we're going to retire that. The end of last year, we ended the year with $600 million of commercial paper. And again, just from our internal assumptions, we're assuming that we're going to retire that as well. Good problem to have. If we need to continue staying in CP, we will. But those are our plans right now. And then we'll opportunistically look at shares, share repos, if that makes sense.
And then just to follow on that, you've brought your leverage down pretty significantly since you completed the Sikorsky acquisition a couple years ago. I think your ratings have been moved to positive at a couple agencies, so you have the potential to get back to an A rating. I guess, how do we think about the balance sheet and the appropriate level of leverage, and how do you kind of balance that against any interest in M&A or anything like that?
Yeah, we're not obviously going to stop an upgrade. You're right, there could be some likelihood we do get one. we're comfortable right now trading at the ratings we have today, and if we get an upgrade, that's great. I think, you know, if you look at our balance sheet, you know, we're sitting with about $14 billion of debt on the balance sheet, you know, end of last year. We're very comfortable with that amount of debt load. And if there was anything out there, you know, that made sense to us, we would utilize our balance sheet. And it would be, you know, if we did it, it would be a compelling reason why we did it. And we certainly would go to the rating agencies to justify why we did that and why it made sense from a synergy standpoint. We were the better owner and progress. Do it.
Excellent. And with that, we've had the clock run down here. So we're out of time. But, Ken, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Seth.